Welcome back. We're going to start session 8 on socialism and a continuation of what's going on in education. All 50 states have an organization they call ACHIEVE to ensure compliance with Goals 2000. That's been some time ago, but under the girding of ACHIEVE, under ACHIEVE was a philosophy called constructivism. Which meant that the students would construct their own unique understanding of content. The national teacher licensing rules were based on constructivism. The philosophy included math. The national teacher licensing rules under mathematics reasoning, as reasoning read, they learned that mathematics is man-made, that it is arbitrary. The good solutions are arrived at by consensus among those who are considered to be experts. Social studies replaced history, where the requirement was not to understand history or the Constitution, but to demonstrate an inquiring attitude toward local, national, and global issues, a commitment to open-mindedness and tolerance for ambiguity, including the attitude that most knowledge is tentative in nature. School to work, called small learning communities, was not something for the future, but was placed in all 50 states. A government-sponsored textbook called We the People stated that the primary purpose of the textbook was not to fill your head with a lot of facts about American history and government. The primary purpose was to develop civic virtue, which was the dedication of citizens to a common good, even at the cost of individual interests. The citizenship is defined as being a member of the state, one who owed allegiance to government. The Bill of Rights was written to protect citizens from the federal government. The textbook, however, suggests that citizens yield the rights to the government. No Child Left Behind continued the system under new names, including forced federal curriculum. By compliance through mandated national assessments, states are accountable to previous federal contracts of Goals 2000 and School to Work. No Child Left Behind presumed implementation of the 1994 standards and assessment requirements. If a state did not have Goals 2000 and School to Work in place, the state lost administrative funds. Mike Cohen, Assistant Secretary for Elementary and Secondary Education for 8 years in the Clinton administration, stated that No Child Left Behind was a clone that was built on the foundations of Goals 2000, except that there were more government accountability measures measured by the tests. The Workforce Investment Act used marketing language to address business leaders with statements such as, it was estimated that American business spent $30 billion annually training and retraining its workforce. More than 50% of the U.S. employers said they could not find qualified applicants for entry-level positions. With school to work in place, they would already be trained. In other words, the schools would be trained right in high school to do menial tasks that employers could hire them. They've already been trained. Well, that saved them $30 billion, supposedly. One of the things about, national sovereignty was addressed in education, and most of the multiculturalism taught to students stressed allegiance away from the national sovereignty of the United States toward a global village headed by the United Nations. Babin wrote a book about the UN. He called it a Mad Hatter's Tea Party, where good was evil, right was wrong, every dictator was given the same privileges as leaders of free nations. The Security Council is interested in tying down the one remaining superpower and making American action taken without the UN permission illegitimate in the eyes of the world. The policy of eliminating terrorists depends on surprise, hitting terrorists where they lurk before they have a chance to run. The UN is the enemy of preemption. When the United States engages in UN debates, the crucial advantage of surprise is lost. The United States cannot even agree on the definition of terrorism. In order for them to be judged of what's good and bad, they have to be somehow know what it is. And Dr. Robert Mueller, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, developed a World Core curriculum, which is supposed to be taught everywhere in the world. And his book was based upon Alice Bailey's Education for a New Age, which she got from a medium, Dwa Kull, a channeled demonic spirit. According to Bailey, education should be a continuous process from birth to death, concerned not so much with acquisition of knowledge as with the expansion of consciousness. The ultimate goal of New Age education is to create an entire new species of human being, the Aquarian man. How did we get from the place where evangelical churches are losing 70 to 80% of their young people when they graduate from high school? Why is America on the verge of national suicide? Why is Western Europe, once the most powerfully impacted by the gospel, a missionary-sending continent, now the most difficult mission field to reach in the world? Why don't 60% of British teens believe in the existence of God? Why do less than 2% of Britons go to church today? Well, part of it's because of John Dewey. The assault on the gospel was led by him. Their main beliefs are, first, the universe is self-existing and not created. Second, that man is a part of nature and that he's emerged as a result of continuous process. James Hutton, the founder of modern geology, stated, "The past history of our globe must be explained by what can be seen to be happening now. No powers are to be employed that are not natural to the globe. No action to be admitted except those which we know in principle." This, of course, rules out supernatural creation and a supernaturally induced global flood at the time of Noah. And Noah Hutton came up with all this information before he'd even bothered to look at a rock. Based on Hutton, Charles Lyell wrote Principles of Geology, in which he tried to free science, the science of geology, from Moses. He wanted to reconstruct Earth history by silencing God's eyewitness testimony about the creation week and the flood. Wayne Grudem, in his Introduction to Systematic Theology, wrote, "What is at stake? A lot. The truthfulness of the three foundational chapters for the entire Bible, 1 through 3, belief in the unity of human race, belief in the ontological uniqueness of human beings among all of God's creatures, belief in special creation of Adam and Eve in the image of God, belief in the parallel between condemnation through the representation by Adam and the salvation through representation by Christ, belief in the goodness of God's original creation, belief that suffering and death today are a result of God's judgment upon the original creation, and the natural disasters today are all part of the fall, not part of God's original intent and in creation. Now we have what we call deconstruction. In more recent times, there's been an adaption of a socialistic tactic called deconstruction. This is where a country's past heroes are portrayed in a negative light so that people emotionally detach from them and their values. Then there's a period of disillusionment and searching. Finally, there's an introduction of rewritten history with socialist values. Dystopian writer George Orwell explained in 1984, "Every record has been destroyed or falsified, every book rewritten, every picture has been repainted, every statue and street building has been renamed, every date has been altered, and the process is continuing today, day by day and minute by minute. History has stopped. Nothing exists except the endless present, which the party is always right. I know, of course, that the past is falsified, but I would never be possible for me to prove it, even if I did the falsification myself. After the thing is done, no evidence ever remains. The only evidence is inside my own mind, and I don't know for certain if any other human being shares my memories." Orwell explained how to alter a nation's trajectory. Those who control the past control the future. Those who control the present control the past. It's actually a sales technique. First, the salesman points out the negative aspects of an old product that the customer is using. Then the customer becomes dissatisfied with it and curious about new options. Then the salesman presents the positive aspects of a new product. Deconstruction does this same thing on a national scale. Deconstruction to drive natural, neutral, and reverse method is to accomplish in the classroom. Separate the students from their past by portraying negatively the country's founding fathers. Get the students into neutral view where they are open-minded, then brainwash students by presenting a positive socialist future. Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States is one of these, this gender. The Senate chaplain Peter Marshall said of deconstruction, "Along with our higher education came a debunking contest, a sort of national sport. It was smarter to revile than to revere. more fashionable to deprecate than to appreciate. Debunking is a sign of a decaying foundation. Cognitive psychologists have carried out experiments where researchers can actually implant false memories in people's minds, making people believe they remember events that never actually occurred. This can be done on a national level. This deconstruction, or what we call cancel culture, involves selectively re-editing or ridiculing past individuals or events in order to advance a future political agenda, altering a nation's past in order to change its future. The 1975 movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail was in this vein, mocking the legendary king Arthur in England's noble history. A scriptwriter for Hollywood sitcoms confided how they were instructed to make them laugh at what was called normally held sacred. One cannot be proud of something and ashamed of something at the same time. Separating people from their past is mentioned and quoted, attributed to Karl Marx. Take away the heritage of a people and they're easily conquered. Yang Bertholma, Minister of Culture in Borneo, wrote in the Brunei Times, August 2013, a nation or generation that does not know its history is a nation that has lost its identity and can be easily manipulated. This is why the Emperor of China, Qin Shi Huangdi, who conquered kingdoms to unify China in 221 BC, destroyed all history books. The basic annals of the first emperor of Qin reported Chancellor Li Si told the emperor in 213 BC, I, your servant, purpose that all historians' records, other than those of Qin's, be burned. If anyone under heaven has copies of the classics of history, they shall deliver them to the governor for burning. Anyone who dares discuss the classics of history shall be publicly executed. Anyone who uses history to criticize the present shall have his family executed. Anyone who has failed to burn books for after 30 days of this announcement shall be subjected to tattooing and be sent to build the Great Wall. President Jimmy Carter started the Department of Education in 1979, and from that time on, the proficiency in math, literature, and history began to decline. Lawrence W. Reed examined this trend in his article, The Myth That Americans Were Poorly Educated Before Mass Government Schooling. Solzhenitsyn stated, if we don't know our own history, we are simply have to endure all the same mistakes, sacrifices, and attitudes all over again. What happened in early America? We should take a look at John Trumbull, a law student under John Adams, and a justice on the Supreme Court of Connecticut, had already read through the Bible for the first time when he was 4 years old. When he was 6, he beat his pastor in a Greek contest, and when he was 7 and a half, he passed the entrance exam to Yale University. Declaration signer Charles Carroll entered college at the age of 10. Fisher Ames entered Harvard when he was 12. Benjamin Rush graduated from Princeton when he was 14. John Quincy Adams was 8 years old when he performed musket drills with the Revolution, during the Revolution with the famous Massachusetts Minutemen. He was secretary to the ambassador of Paris, and at the age of 14, he received similar appointment to the court of Catherine the Great in Russia. The early education law was the Old Luther Satan Act. Civil and religious leaders in Europe had wrongly taught that masses that the Bible authorized such atrocities that it further authorized individual leaders of the church and state to wield great and often tyrannical power over the people. Because the people were illiterate and therefore couldn't read the scriptures to judge the accuracy of what the leaders told them, they blindly believed and followed, thus indirectly abetting the commission of those atrocities. Learning from these tragedies, the American settlers were convinced that if the common people could read and learn the word of God for themselves and study the limits on the governing authorities set forth in the Bible, citizens would resist government misbehavior and thus preclude several similar occurrences in America. What was it that they were learning? Well, elementary math problems during the 1860s were such as this. I insured 2/3 of a shop worth $3,600. 4/5 of a house worth $6,000. Paying $126, what was the rate of insurance? Or how about this one? This is an elementary school math question. How much money must be given with 9 $100 shares at 15% discount in exchange for 8 $100 bonds at 2% discount? Or consider math problems from 1877, mental math tests, no pencil and no paper allowed. a boat worth $864, of which 1/8 belonged to A, 1/4 belonged to B, and the rest to C was lost. What loss did each sustain having been insured for $500? Or how about this one? On a farm, there were 60 animals, horses, cows, and sheep. For each horse, there were 3 cows. For each cow, there were 2 sheep. How many animals were there of each kind? Or how about this one? If 7 men can do a piece of work in 4 days, in what time can it be done if 3 of the men leave when the work is half completed? Well, we see how this is what public schools were teaching back then. When most kids were homeschooled, they didn't have public education, but they were able to learn at a very early age. What is the effect of the Center for Civic Education, a non-governmental organization, has redefined what education is and what's to be taught? The effect has been to reduce education to job skills, to prepare a generation to accept a global form of government based on a Marxist economy, the elimination of any mention of the Second Amendment, and the overemphasis on the environment, tolerance, global citizenship, along with the certification of teachers and extensive NAEP testing, which focuses more on attitudes and beliefs than on math and reading, and demonstrates what the stated agendas of the new federal curriculum are. They rewrite the nation's curriculum. National Standards for Civics and Government states civic education instead should be considered central to the purposes of American education. It also states that achievement of these standards should be fostered not only by explicit attention to civic education in the curriculum, but also in related subjects such as history, literature, geography, economics, and the sciences, and by informal curriculum of the school, the pattern of relations mentioned in the school and its governance. In other words, include all of this stuff in every field, in every subject. And we'd redefine the media. The UN-sponsored World Declaration on Education for All in 1990, which called for most of the education changes that are being made in the United States to support basic education activities, not to report the basic education activities. It means, in the words of Agenda 21, shaping public behavior. Well, this is a call that I would say is to abandon public schools altogether. There are certain things that were never written in the Bible to actually exist. And one was public schools, controlled by the government, especially a humanistically controlled government. No, parents were to teach their children at home. Public schools today can waste 12 years of your children's life. They can cripple your child's ability to read. They can deceive parents into thinking their children are doing well in school when they're not. They can indoctrinate children with anti-parent, anti-American, and anti-Judeo-Christian values. They can expose innocent children to shocking sexual material in so-called sex education classes. And they can pressure parents to give their children potentially dangerous mind-altering drugs such as Ritalin. There's a book written called Abolition, Overcoming the Christian Establishment on Education. And the book contends that the public school should be abolished. The government's days of dictating what ideas our children are exposed to are numbered. The government school system is going to be abolished, as God never granted the government the right to use force to and coercion to advance thought. Christians are to on notice of this, as most of them foolishly think they can reform a government school system which should not exist in the first place, since the government school system is a tyrannical mechanism that commands our youth to think in anti-Christian terms. It must be abolished based on how God ordains the family to raise children in the Lord's nurture and admonition. If Christians disregard the Christian establishment, public schools, we may have a revival. On the average today, 30 out of a 30 student high school class, 15 are sexually active. There are 23 believe in homosexuality as an acceptable alternative lifestyle. 14 don't see a great risk in heavy daily drinking. 12 of them have used marijuana. 9 admitted to stealing from a store within the past year. 24 admitted to lying to their parents about something significant. 18 admitted to cheating on a test during the last year. And even though they have done all these things, 20 out of 30 are satisfied with their personal ethics and character. The moral decline of our youth is truly astounding. But we have an even bigger problem. Between 70 and 88% of our children from Christian homes walk away from the visible church by the end of their freshman year in college. That means that more than 7 out of 10 of our children end up in the road to spiritual destruction. According to a national survey done by Britt Beamer, America's research group, we start to lose our children as early as elementary school, with around 40% of them deciding to walk away from the visible church by the end of middle school. The percent increases to 80% by the end of the senior year of high school. Almost 9 out of the 10 Christian families, 89%, send their children to public schools. Jerry Bergman, who had 4 earned doctorates, something like 5 or 6 master's degrees, he was fired from his job at Ohio University. And he wrote a book called Slaughter of the Dissidents, where he interviewed 300 people, 300 scientists and educators who had had the same thing happen to them. He found out that they were basically lost their job because they weren't teaching evolution. And so he basically went and documented this in a book called Slaughter of the Dissidents. And he couldn't find anybody to publish it because he said freedom of expression is true in America. We have a right to free speech. It's our First Amendment, but not in the academic world, not in the academic world. We have basically the teachers have been silenced. And this happened as a result of putting people in positions of power who would control what the teachers, what teachers were hired and what they taught. And so they could be fired simply by not teaching evolution, which is false all the way through. There's nothing true about evolution. Yet if they want to teach the truth, they're let go. They lose their tenure. They lose everything. So he wrote the book Slaughter of the Dissidents, and I got it chapter by chapter before anybody did because nobody would publish it. Finally, he did get it published. He wrote a second book called Silencing the Darwin Skeptics. When somebody doesn't have an argument, they use name calling. And so the name calling was used by the media about Darwin skeptics, anybody that didn't believe in Darwin. They were called incompetent, ignoramuses, retrogressives, stupid, liars, unqualified, idiots, mentally retarded, and about 40 other names. With clarity and thoroughness, Bergman detailed the accounts of 17 of these 300 scientists and educators he interviewed and showed that these people were not necessarily, not all of them were even Christians. They just didn't believe that evolution had scientific basis. And so the frequency of the terms used to call these people dangerous was 303,000 times for creationists, young earth creationists. For intelligent design people, they did this 484,000 times for a total of 787,000 times. They called them dangerous just because they believed in creation as opposed to evolution. They called them a threat, stupid, ignorant, dumb, fools, uneducated, bigots, flat earthers, jerks, all these things, and continued to call them these names because when you don't have an argument, many times you result to simply name calling. Now, we look at property. The opposite of individuals owning property is social ownership of property. This is socialism, which in application is no different from the feudal lord holding the land in a trust and dividing it among his loyal knights and vassals, who in turn collect taxes from the poor peasants. Webster's 1828 dictionary defined property as the exclusive right of possessing, enjoying, or disposing of a thing, ownership. Karl Marx wrote, "The theory of communists may be summed up in one sentence, abolition of private property." Reagan explained in October 27, 1964, how government regulations effectively take away property. Now, it doesn't require confiscation of private property or business to impose socialism. What does it mean whether you hold the deed to your business or property? Machinery already exists where the government can find some charge to bring against any concern it chooses to prosecute. Every businessman has his own tale of harassment. What does the Bible say about property? Throughout the scriptures, God gives men and women property to be stewards over. Genesis 2:15 says, "And the Lord God took man and put him on the Garden of Eden to work and to keep it. The Ten Commandments confirm private ownership of property with the command, thou shalt not steal the property of another, Exodus 20, verse 15, nor even covet your neighbor's property, Deuteronomy 5, 21. Neither shalt thou covet thy neighbor's house, his field, his ox, his ass, or anything that is thy neighbor's. Naboth refused to sell his property to King Ahab. King Ahab spake unto Naboth, saying, give me thy vineyard, that I may have it for a garden, and I will give thee the worth of it in money. And Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid it me that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee. An employer can negotiate to pay a worker wages. And once the work is complete, the wages are the worker's property. John Adams explained in the Defense of the Constitution of the Government of the United States in 1787, the consequence if private property is not protected, property is surely a right of mankind. Perhaps at first, principle or religion would restrain the poor from attacking the rich, but the time would not be long before courage and enterprise would come and pretexts be invented by decrees to countenance the majority in dividing all the property among them, or at least in sharing it equally with its present possessors. Debts would be abolished first, taxes laid heavy on the rich and not at all on the others, and alas, a downright equal division of everything be demanded and voted. Adams continued, what would be the consequence of this? The idle, the vicious, the intemperate would rush into the utmost extravagance of debauchery, sell and spend all their share, and then demand a new division of those who purchased from them. The moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the laws of God, and that there is not a force of law and public justice to protect it, anarchy and tyranny commence. If thou shalt not covet, and thou shalt not steal, were not commandments of heaven, they must be made inviolable, secure precepts in every society before it can be civilized or made free. When the government gives anything out, it usually is in exchange for something. When there was a famine in Egypt, the government gave grain in exchange for the people's freedoms, their lives, and their children. When the government gives anything, whether it's the recipient realizes it or not, it's in exchange for something, such as freedom, political loyalty, or votes. As well-intended government programs may be, they are run by career politicians and bureaucrats who have an inherent conflict of interest. In addition to running a program, they do not want the program to end, as they would lose their justification for their jobs. If a politician is popular because he champions the needs of the poor, he has a vesting interest in the continuation of the poor staying poor as a voting constituency. If there were no poor no longer, he would lose his voting block and may not be reelected. Representative J.C. Watts described such politicians. I have my thoughts. I think they're race hustling poverty pimps, Watts added. For the past 30 years, our nation spent $5 trillion trying to erase poverty, and as a result, as you know, is we didn't get rid of it at all. In fact, we spread it. We destroyed our self-esteem of millions of people, grinding them down in a welfare system that penalizes moms for wanting to marry the father of their children and penalizes moms for wanting to save money. Friends, that's not right. Politicians also may be tempted to redirect public funds as favors and pork projects to loyal party members and supporters who can help them stay in office. Buchanan discovered that rather than big disinterested public servants, a large percentage of career bureaucrats are primarily interested in self-preservation. It is natural for people to want to keep their jobs. When millions of people work for the government, there is a collective desire for it to get bigger as job security, creating an enormous deep state bureaucracy. Government employees are tempted to use their positions to perpetuate their jobs while harassing, auditing, leaking, investigating, and persecuting those who would threaten to eliminate their jobs. Reagan stated in October 27, 1964, he said, no government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size. So government programs, once launched, never disappear. Actually, a government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we've ever seen on earth. And with that, I would like to close. Thank you for listening.